Tonight we're speaking to Pete Mesley. Pete Mesley is an explorer, expert wreck and technical diver, CCR instructor, and PADI course director, with over 3,000 hours of in-water diving experience. He's based in New Zealand and has been the first to dive a number of its wrecks. Pete is also an accomplished underwater photographer and videographer who has led diving expeditions to some of the most iconic dive destinations around the world. Diving the Podcast is a weekly all about diving podcast for everyone. Whether you explore the oceans as a snorkeler, scuba diver, free diver, or tech diver, Dive In has something for you. The show is filled with diving news, feature interviews with guests from around the world, interesting dive topics, and ocean advocacy. Visit diveinpod.com to find out about the show, past guests, and our Patreon.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us on another episode of Dive in the Podcast. This is episode 101, and this week we're doing our second half of our interview with Pete Mesley. So if you haven't heard the first half, Nick and April sat down with Pete a few weeks ago. We did the first half of this interview. It was an hour-long interview. It was great. We have a second half about the same length coming up today. But if you haven't heard the first half, go back to episode 99, just two episodes back, and take a listen before listening to this one, so you can learn all about the man, the myth, the legend, Pete, and all his fun stories and everything. I'm going to hand it back over to April and Nick, and they're going to finish up this interview with Pete Mesley. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Dive in the Podcast. We're speaking with Pete Mesley. He's a world-renowned wreck and rebreather diver, owner of Lust for Rest, and Shock and Awe Big Animal Expeditions. So, Pete, how did Lust for Rest Expeditions business first come about?
Hey, April. So, after a number of years, I think it was 1994-95, I started working for dive operations as a training manager and all the rest of it. And in 2000, I worked all the way up until about 2005. And I was working 100-hour weeks and getting paid what we all, consider a king's ransom as a diving instructor, which, what they say about what's the difference between a diving instructor and a pizza. And a pizza can feed a family of four, where a diving instructor can't. And so it was a bit challenging. So I thought I'd just go out and take a bit of a risk and go out alone. So that's where Lust for Rust was born, really, because I'd been taking trips out through dive stores for the last 11 years, and I thought, well, let's give it a go. At that time, I was still contracting as an instructor trainer to dive stores. So that kept the money coming in, and I just started running trips. The first trip that I went to was organized was a place called Truk Lagoon, and a lot of people will know Truk or Chuuk, and I went there as one of my once in a lifetime trips. And, of course, just like everybody, we all have our bucket list of destinations. And as the years go by, that bucket list doesn't get any smaller. In fact, it gets larger. So I just turned around to myself and I said, look, man, I better start, trying to cancel off these bucket list destinations. And so I finally got to Truk Lagoon and for my once in a lifetime trip there, and I realized after day one that I already started to replan going back, because I just realized that this destination was worthy of many, many return trips. And so that's kind of where I really got started with the Lust for Rest diving excursions, and then I created a niche there. There was absolutely nothing. Truk Lagoon was 99% recreational diving, and there were 17 wrecks there deeper than 50 meters that just don't get dived at all. So that was a number of years ago, and so over the years, this would be my next trip this year, would have been trip number 36 for me. So, you know, I've even after all those times and all those hundreds of hours in the water with on these wrecks, I still get goosebumps thinking about my next trip there, because it's just such an amazing resource. And they boast 60 wrecks, but there's about 38 which are world class dives, and 60% of those are within recreational depth limits. And so it's not just only about deep diving. So so we're diving these, and I bought 20 sets of rebreather cylinders, and I bought some stage cylinders and some webbing and et cetera, and basically a couple of ton of soft alignment, and we got set up, and ever since, you know, we've been running trips there a couple of times, sometimes three or four times a year, and with groups from 12 to 55 people, you know, and people go, oh man, that's a huge amount, but you know, we've got like the smaller vessels, so we're land-based, so the smaller vessels will take a maximum of 6 technical divers, and then my policy is we do one boat per wreck, so we don't have more than one boat on a wreck at any one time. So there's plenty of wrecks to go around, and all the guys just disappear in the morning and they go for their dive and they come back, and the only time that they realize that we've got quite a large group is round the bar at the après drinks that night, talking about all the big ones that got away and all the big war stories. You know, that's where all some of the biggest stories get told around there. So, yeah, the rest is history.
You mentioned earlier in the interview that your lovely wife learned to dive so she could spend lots of time with you. So, is your wife part of the business as well?
No, unfortunately, I've had to keep her here in Auckland working full time in order for me to be accustomed to the lifestyle that I've grown to love. So both of us can't go gallivanting around, and messing around the world. So Kim is she is the foundation stone of everything behind the scenes here. So I've got two daughters, and they're not so young anymore. One is 20 and one's 16, and you know, she's been amazing, you know, over these years. Well, you know, I'd on average spend about 19 weeks a year away from home, so that's quite a challenge for a young family. So
absolutely,
yeah.
You alluded to just a moment ago a little bit about what it might take to set up these expeditions, and I was just wondering, yeah, what would you have to do to support the technical, the rebreather side to going, and what must be in some places remote? Like, what does that take?
I think, like, equipment, it's the easiest thing in the world. You just throw some money at it and you can just get yourself some gear shipped over there and all the rest of it. So that's only like a small portion of the whole operation. What I learned very, very early on was because we're doing multiple repetitive decompression diving and a very, very provocative dive profiles. That's kind of, you know, it's really on the edge of where we're at the moment. And because back in one of the earliest trips that I was running, we had a diver fatality on our trip, and this was in 2006, very, you know, like, it's just a real massive tragedy, and this girl ended up dying on the trip as a result of a diver related injury, and I. You know, obviously we did everything right, et cetera, but the biggest difference was that in Truk Lagoon, the medical, like the hospital, my goodness, the hospital was non-existent. It was a concrete room with a stainless steel gurney on it, and that was kind of it. And we had a fully functional recompression chamber there, which is fantastic. But the medical support in the hospital was just non-existent. So I then set about saying, well, listen, there's no ways that I can fully prevent this from happening again. But what I could do is I can take every step capable and known to man to offer the highest level of medical support that we can. And so I, again, with my friends in high places, I consulted Simon and quite a few other medical professionals that I'm friendly with, and now is part of my policy to bring a hyperbaric physician, and we've got a pretty awesome medical kit. Now we won't be able to take your appendix out. I'll give it a go, but we've got a lot of equipment and if anything, to help preserve and extend life, so that before, you know, if someone was critically ill, we could respond in a manner of which we could do a lot better than the local hospital could. And as a result of that, for the next 12 years, every time that I would come into Truk Lagoon, I would bring in a bag full of medical supplies for the local hospital, and just little things that we would never think twice about are stuff that they really appreciated. So things have got a lot better since then. But I've learned the fact that by having that medical support has been a game changer, and even though without a shadow of a doubt, I've kind of led the way in this type of technical diving expeditions and all the rest of it, but man, the more people that are running these trips in the future, for them to actually, I have quite a few people contact me and say, look, can you help me out and all the rest of it. And of course, I don't consider them competitors or, the foe, the enemy, but they're fellow diving professionals. And if someone wants to go on a trip with somebody else instead of me, well, then I'm not doing my job well enough. So the people that have contacted me are asking my help in terms of what I do for medical support and all the rest of it. I've been fully open with any advice that I can give. And at the end of the day, if every technical trip had their own medical support, I don't want anyone getting hurt on anyone's trips. Mm-hmm. So with that comes a responsibility, and the other thing too is some of the presentations that I've done for technical conferences in the past, where I've spoken about, what sort of questions should you be asking when you are thinking about going on a technical diving trip? Because someone says, "Hey, man, I'm running a technical diving trip to." I don't know, XYZ, Acme diving resort in the middle of nowhere. And you go, well, okay, fair enough. So you can buy dive cylinders, oxygen generation plants, some sorb and some manifold and stages, whatever, and you've got the gear. But what do you actually need to know to really understand the risks of being and diving in these operations? Because people don't really understand that, like they go, oh, we'll just ring Dan. Well, Dan are a fantastic operation, a fantastic organization, but most of the time they're a minimum of 30 to 60 hours away. So if someone is critically injured and critically hurt, if you're undergoing technical diving operations and you don't have a chamber nearby, well, I would be reconsidering. I'd be reconsidering how I'm thinking about doing that trip, because having a chamber is one thing, but having the medical support to be able to go hand in hand with that, because then at the end of the day, if someone gets hurt, then they can get fixed. Now, obviously, if someone is life or death or critically injured, well, then we just do the best that we can. But if all the sort of like the niggles, you know, all the small decompression illness cases where, you know, people get musculoskeletal, like they their arm doesn't work anymore or whatever. So like, now that's not a life threatening situation, but it could be if it takes 60 hours for that person to get treatment, and then, you know, like they're just like, you know, they're not going to have a good time at all. So this is where the responsibility of the industry and hopefully playing a small role in helping people understand, because then when an operator will say, "Hey man, we're running a technical trip 250 mile offshore, and we're going to be doing deep trimix diving," and you go, "Oh, that's awesome. So like, what process have we got in place if something happens?" And then the other thing too, though, is if let's just say we're all on a trip, right? Mm-hmm. So we're all on a dive trip, our trip of a lifetime, and then day one I get bent, and then everyone just turns around and goes back, that's the end of your holiday. And everyone goes, "Yeah, what's up there?" Now, obviously, if someone's life or death situation, then we will do whatever it takes to do that. But then something which is totally avoidable, so that now if there was a recompression chamber on board, and the person goes, "Oh, my elbow hurts," so now everyone, the whole trip ends for something which is completely avoidable, where if we had the correct equipment, the correct support, to be able to offer this type of diving, then we say, "Well, okay, the person will get put in the chamber. They would get fixed. They obviously wouldn't be able to dive for the rest of the trip, but everybody else and all diving operations will carry on and take place." And you know what I mean? It's not the end. But then if someone gets quite badly injured, then that we've got the support there to be able to treat them, etc., etc. So, you know, it's a big responsibility, and the more people can understand that from a consumer point of view, where they can say, "These are the questions that I need to ask," and from a professional point of view, saying, "Listen, man, this is what I want to do. So how am I going to go about that? So then when you come on my trip, I'm going to explain to you all the risks involved." So that now, and then suddenly people go, "Hey man, it must be fine if people are going there," you know, and they kind of just need to kind of take a little bit of responsibility for that sort of thing, you know. That's
interesting, because it also makes a lot of business sense, right? Because for a minor injury, if you'd have to turn around a whole boat, right?
Totally, man. Because you know, at the end of the day, you can have an operator say, "Well, we're not going to invest in, because it's going to cost money, right? We need to put a chamber on board. That's going to cost money." And then, how many times will someone get bent on a series of trips? And they say, "One out of five trips. Well, we can manage that." You know what I mean? So you got to, this type of operators like that, you want to keep an eye out for them, you know, and because at the end of the day, we all just want to go out and have some fun, but we want to manage danger. We want everything to be managed so that it's achievable. And like if someone says, "Hey man, we're going to go out on this trip, there's a likelihood, a 1 in 4 chance that someone's going to get bent. We got no medical support. So do you want to come or not?" If someone gets bent, then the trip is over for everyone. And everyone goes, "That trip's going to cost me $10,000 US. Let me try and go somewhere where someone's actually thinking about it a little bit more. And I don't want to pay more, you know." And then, but anyway, we digress, or do we?
They've also developed the shock and awe Big Animal Expedition brand. Can you tell us a little bit more about that endeavor?
Okay, so back in the day, so my, you know, I love wrecks, and I created the Lust for Us Diving Excursion brand, and then and then as that grew, I just love aquatic life, and I'm really into big animals and all the rest of it. So it was very difficult for me to try and do a Lust for Us trip to Socorro or to Galapagos, so I just created another sideline brand, which is the Shock and Awe, and so that's kind of it's a bit of fun, because then we got the Shock and Awe big animal diving, and then we got the Shock and Awe wet rocks, where I've never really been into cave diving until I went to Mexico and went diving with some friends of mine out of Tulum at Under the Jungle, and in fact Vince is one of my students, my ex-students, where I taught him to become an instructor, and he's done extremely well for himself, and he's partnered up with Nat Gibb, and they're just a fantastic partnership, and I just love going diving with them. So I'm quite into the wet rocks now. So especially like taking pictures, and I didn't think I'd have as much fun doing it, but I'm really enjoying that. So I'll be hopefully trying to sneak back this year if I'm allowed, if the government here allows me to go or come back.
I got two questions, but I guess the first one: what sort of places do your Shock and Awe trips take your guests to, and what kind of things do they see?
You're probably not going to be looking at muck diving or nudibranch diving or anything like that. We're into the big animals, so Galapagos. I've been to the Galapagos quite a few times now, and it's not necessarily technical diving trips. But we just, enjoying enjoying the environment, and obviously I had four trips to Socorro planned and fully booked, and with our wonderful friend the pandemic, the COVID, that kind of put the kibosh on things. But you know what, like. We've all suffered, and we just gotta just brush off and pick ourselves up and carry on, And it's like, we've got this pandemic, and it's affected the world massively over the last couple of years. But if we don't pick up and move forward, then we're just gonna dig a hole and live in a hole for the rest of our lives. So we just got to make do with what we've got and appreciate what we've got. So I also like run trips to Palau. Palau is just an oasis, and it's pretty much got everything. And I've been enjoying quite a few different opportunities there, and there's some friends of mine who operate on the Sam's Dive Tours, and there's a company called Unique Diving Expeditions, and Paulie and Richie have basically cornered the fish aggregation and the spawning, and they've completely cornered that side of the market, which is just an incredible environment and something to witness, where you've got these massive bumphead wrasse and the spawning and the aggregation, all the shark aggregations and Moorish idols, and it's an incredible, and it's just the more we learn about these different environments, it just makes sense to go and have some fun and witness that firsthand. So that's what I've been enjoying,
I brought the pandemic up a second ago. How did you adapt during the sort of the last 2 years? And obviously from New Zealand, I guess traveling in and out's been a bit more of a problem than maybe other countries, right?
Oh yeah. I just tell my wife to work harder. I've been very lucky because, international business stopped 100% overnight, and And like I saw, we've all got to adapt. And I had to completely rethink my business strategies. And because of the fact that I spend so much time away from home, I kind of neglected the New Zealand market quite substantially, and it's been really awesome to reestablish myself back in New Zealand and get back to core business, which has been training and creating. Like, I bought myself a little rib, a little 6 meter rib, and that's been quite fun to go out and she's aptly named the Rust Hunter. So we've been doing some prospecting and I've got a side scan sonar and just creating and going to go looking for more shipwrecks and having a look at some of our fantastic reef systems, which the vast majority of the East Coast here is just totally underdiscovered. So I've been having a lot of fun doing that doing some film work and some documentary programs, all the rest of it on natural history. Like I said, we've spent some time filming orcas and false killer whales, which is, surrounding yourself with people who are like experts in their field, and that's been pretty cool. And
your inner marine biologist coming out there.
Yeah, it's kind of coming in full circle, isn't it? So I'm learning stuff which I'm just super stoked about learning about and just being around these people I have to say that sometimes I feel guilty sending the invoice for my time because I'm just having such a good time. I think it's wrong that I've got to charge for it, but then again, that guilt just disappears within a second, so it's fine. I'll send the invoice.
Well, especially when you go buy rebreather supplies, right?
So I'm looking. That $40 million yacht is, it costs money to run that thing.
That's right. So from your,
it doesn't pay for itself. Yeah.
No, I always thought they did, but no, they don't. So from where you're at, and like because you've been running this business for some time, like how do you see the outlook on going forward on travel, on dive travel?
Oh, mate, the thing is that we're a resilient bunch, and two things can happen, right? One is that people dig a hole and they become hermits and they just hide away for the rest of their life. Or the guys go, hey man, I've got some wealth here, I might as well spend it because tomorrow might be the zombie apocalypse. So let's just go out and do the things that we wanted to do, not wait for tomorrow. Let's do it now. And it's been my experience that the majority of people are thinking on the latter. They're just going, oh man, this has proven to us, it's shown us that life is so short. And I think things that are important to us, which we used to think were important to us, are like stuff, right? Like tactile things which bear no value in our lives, but yet we're so intent on wanting a new mobile phone, a new car, a new this, a new that. Whereas you're going, why don't we just focus on the things that we want to do? Like, I've always wanted to go to Socorro or the Galapagos or whatever destination you want to go to, and you start planning towards that, and then with that, you will need a travel operator that will help you every step of the way. We'll have some fun at the same time, but again, I think at the end of the day, we just gotta figure out what we want to do and then focus on that. And that's one of the big pluses that have come out of this for me is spending more time with my family, my daughters, and my wife. even though my wife would be looking at the calendar. I've got a big calendar on my wall, which is normally like 2 years out, and she's going, "Oh, how long do I have to put up with you until you leave?" And he goes, "Oh, 3 weeks. Oh, I can do that. I can do another 3 weeks." I'm just surprised that I haven't been sort of like gagged and you know, suffocated in my sleep, you know. But no, she's a good girl, you know, and my girls are you know, just it's great fun messing around with them and watching them growing up. And so yeah, just I cannot classes. Complain, you know. Yeah, I can't complain, you know. I bought myself, you won't see this because it's a podcast, but I bought myself a little diver, you see. Oh, no, one of these model divers. Look at that, you see.
Oh, I've been thinking about getting one of those.
That is just expensive as hell, but you know what? When I'm not diving, I'm thinking about it. Look at that. look at that trim. Look at that. Awesome.
They're custom made, aren't they?
They are. They're amazing. You know, that's like $600 worth of toy there, but well worth it, because that's the best trim you're ever going to see coming out of me, I'll tell you. Look at that. I suppose it's a podcast, and no one can see, so I guess we'll just cut that one out, you know.
What you need is just a little spring, and then you can put it on the dashboard of your yacht, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. On the dash, yeah. Beside the fluffy dice. Yeah.
Pete, yeah, what is the Worldwide Rec Baseline Project?
Oh man, yeah, that is a little project that has been kind of my little baby for the last few years, and it all started with I wanted to 3D map all the wrecks in Truk Lagoon. And there's like 3D mapping. I never thought that I'd get into it, you know, because, you know, I'm when it comes to photography, I'm kind of what you would call an arty-farty photographer. Like, it's all, you know, like lighting and a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And it's all arty-farty, right? And in photogrammetry, when you take 5,000 or 6,000 pictures of a wreck, there's nothing arty about it whatsoever. You're just basically gathering data, of which you plug into a computer, and it spits out this 3D model. And I never thought that I would be into it so much. And is a mate of mine that is an expert in this. His name is Marcus Blatchford, and I partnered up with Marcus, and I said, you know, we've got him out to Truk Lagoon, and we started modeling these wrecks, and I never thought that I'd have as much fun doing it, and that's kind of grown, and just learning and understanding about how these models are made, and from there I thought, well, why stop at Truk Lagoon? Because, you know, like having a model is, there's many different applications to having a 3D model for a start. Once you've created this data and this model, it's timeless. So like now, over the next 100 years, when that ship disappears, that model is still going to be there for everyone to look at and enjoy, to be able to say, well, this is one of those wrecks. So like now, eventually, and this is kind of where the Worldwide Wreck Baseline Project has come into effect, where I'm saying, well, if everybody around the world is making these amazing models, creating like a center point where people can like all the idea is not to, you know, like people's models, that's their property, you know, but having a central hub where, like, if I wanted to find out, okay, look, I want to go diving Lake Michigan, and I have an idea of what the wrecks are in Lake Michigan, and then on the website you'll have a look, and then the guys that are doing all the modeling in Michigan, that all pops up, and then suddenly you've got all this information, and you get sent to the site, and then you can learn about that, etc., etc. So that really that sparked my interest, and it's kind of like I've got no commercial purpose in it whatsoever, you know, but purely for the fact that if we've got everyone putting all these together, and then like from an educational point of view, my goodness, you got these people wanting to learn about underwater archaeology, and you got these 3D models where they can actually learn about going straight into these sites and looking at all this amphora pottery on the bottom, and these guys down in Malta are doing some amazing things with heritage down in Malta, and so can you imagine putting all of that together? And okay, so you've got commercial companies like National Geographic or Discovery. So they want to use one of those models in their shows. Well, they pay for that, and then that helps making more models, and then helps the people that are creating and designing, you know, and gathering up all this information, helps them to do a little bit more, etc. So you know, it's only the beginning, and I'm super, super excited about this. But at the end of the day, it's like with everything, it's it needs money, but you've got to start with the first step. You've got to start with the first move forward, with the technology that's coming around these days, and the amount of people that are getting into photogrammetry, it's just awesome. Where if we can have that spot where people can just come to and they can enjoy these models, and I think it's pretty cool. And hopefully, I'll never stop doing it, and hopefully we'll be able to. Partner up with people and say, look, whether they're interested in sharing their web links and so everyone can come to one spot and enjoy them. That's kind of where we're at.
That's pretty cool. I saw that earlier on your website, and I sent a link to a local diver of ours that we had in a podcast recently, Michael, and because he's been doing that around here on our local wrecks. I sent him a link to your website, so I haven't heard back from him yet, but I'm sure he'll be drooling all over it.
Yeah, you know what I mean. So it's like everyone's models will still remain their property and always will be, but it's just having a world map, and then you can say, hey man, in New Zealand, New Zealand, click on there, and then the models that come up, and then you can check them out, you know. And
so cool.
Same thing globally. So. Anyway, we'll see. It's a work in progress, It's a work in progress.
But you have created some amazing and beautiful imagery during your career. What prompted you to take up photography?
Going all the way back to the first session, we talked about me learning to dive in England, right? And one of the primary pastimes in England was what we call spidge collecting, which is basically artifact recovery. And I was never any good at that. I was absolutely terrible at recovering portholes or things like that. So I found also that by me taking pictures, I tended to get invited on more trips, because I wouldn't be the ones vying for opportunity for people to take the artifacts and all the rest. But obviously, that's all changed now, and none of that gets done anymore, which is good, because most of the artifacts will end up rotting at the side of someone's garage somewhere, in between the fence and the garage in the long grass, So taking pictures, and that was what started me into it, and then all of it just grew, because I just wanted to document initially document wrecks, and then it just started to grow from there, and then photography was kind of my release, my enjoyment, my pastime. So when I was teaching, I loved doing that. And all the rest of it. But when I wasn't teaching, I would get my camera and I'd go out and mess around. I could dive the same site many, many times and get just as much enjoyment out of it, because I wanted to get a better photograph of whatever it was I was taking a picture of. So I really enjoyed it, and I still do. I've been over the last 8 or 9 years, I've been perfecting images where you would never ever see on a dive. You'd never ever see that because it's such a large area I'd spend 3.5 hours on a dive to take one picture, and that would give me, and it still does give me, immense enjoyment. You know, all long time exposure images where it would take me hours to light paint, and the, you know, 99% of the time they would never come out, and then I'd go back and then I'd do it again and then I'd go back and I'd do it again, and so that's given me a lot of fun and enjoyment, I'm loving it, you know.
I was going to say light painting on the water has got to be such a trial and error project. But the other thing is that I think of when I think of wrecks, they're often dark on the inside. You know, you get a lot of tight passages and obviously they're prone to silting up. How do you overcome these challenges? Like, I mean, there must be a creative side to that.
Have impeccable buoyancy. Amazing skills. No, well, you do kind of. So obviously, I don't know how many times I've like. So it's very difficult to picture a scene, but trying like. So when I go inside these wrecks, I've got extendable tripods. I've got maybe 8 or 9 lights, and when you think of the word ergonomic, you will not be seeing a picture of me in the dictionary under that word, because I am everything but ergonomic. So trying to get into these places with all this equipment is fairly challenging in itself. And then finding the right frame is another challenge. And then once I've found the frame that I want, then I'll set the camera up and the tripod. So setting the tripod up inside this area will maybe take me 45 minutes, because one careless fin stroke, I'll just kick up a silt, and then all you see is just silt. So, there's some images that, that I've done, and it's obviously this is a podcast and no one can see anything, but these images have taken me 5 or 6 years to take, because I'll set the camera up. And one particular image is a view of looking down through an engine room from the skylight, looking down through. And that image took me about 6 years to take, because not because I just couldn't take it, it's because I'd set the camera up, and then as soon as I would get ready to start light painting, in would come all the divers, and they would just destroy all of the visibility, and I just end up having to unclip everything and just leave again, you know. So it's immensely rewarding and gratifying to get these images to come out, and that's what keeps me going, man. I have a bit of fun.
That's pretty awesome. As a photographer, I can just imagine how that goes, and that's, I think, light painting on the water. I think something I haven't tried yet, so I'm gonna have to do that. You also had the opportunity to be part of an Nat Geo expedition to the HMHS Britannic. What was your role in that project?
So this is in 2009. So I've been a couple of times, one in 2009 and one in 2015. On the National Geographic Britannic trip in 2009, I was part of a 10-diver team, and basically we were the objectives of that doco was to prove how Britannic sank, because it only took less than a minute for it to sink, and which is like unbelievable. Like, how can an ocean liner just sink in such a short period of time? And so we were divided into two teams of five, we had penetration teams and line laying teams, and also videography and photography. So I was the primary photographer on one of the teams, and a good mate of mine, Lee Bishop, was primary photographer on the second team, and yeah, I mean, we basically our primary objective was to document and to try and answer some of the questions that have now quite a few of them have been answered. There was some talk about Britannic being torpedoed by the Germans, German U-boat, which obviously torpedoing a hospital ship is kind of a big no-no. So there was a lot of talk about that. Then there was a lot of innuendo about Britannic carrying ordnance. And then again, that's kind of a big no-no, hiding and shielding ordnance under the red star of the hospital ships. So all of these sort of things were questions that needed to be answered. We could only partially answer a small amount of the questions during that trip because of obviously one of my best friends ended up dying in my arms. Carl Spencer ended up dying in my arms and while we're on decompression on that dive, that fateful dive in 2009. So that was kind of the end of the trip for everybody and it was one of the saddest days of my life, anyway.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah, well, these things happen.
You've been a lot of places in the world. You've dived a lot of wrecks. Do you have a favorite dive site wreck?
Oh man, that's like I do. The Ikoka Maru in Truk Lagoon. No, hang about. No, it's the Nagano in Truk. Yeah, definitely the Nagano. No. Britannic. Britannic's my favorite. Yeah, Britannic. No. In fact, I think it's the San Francisco Maru. I'm joking, mate. Every single dive that it's just enjoy what that dive is and also the people that are around me, that's kind of, you know what they say about the only way that you can drink a fine wine is with good friends and good food? Well, that's kind of the same philosophy that we approach on our big trips, or any forget about the big trip, but on any trip, we share these sort of cool things and if we can't share them, it's not as fun, is it?
I think April's been building up the dive community here in the last 2 years or so, and I think she's definitely connected to the social element as part of that. So I think she'll be able to relate.
Well, keeping people diving and keeping people together is what it's all about. And with you, younger generation, and all us deadwood, it's great to see that to see that expand and because we are a global community, and who cares whether you like. You dive in side mount or back mount or a rebreather or no rebreather. Who cares? No, it's just a piece of kit, you need that piece of kit in order to get you to do the things that you're going to be doing. So, I think people focus on the wrong element of the process. It takes all types, and we're there to educate, aren't we, April? Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Yes.
I like it. I like your mindset, Pete, because I'm the same. I'm like, you do what works for you. I mean, I'll say this is what I dive and this is the equipment I have, but, you could try it and love it or you could try it and hate it. I know people that love a piece of equipment that I don't like. So, yeah, I'm all about whatever works for you.
Yeah, 100%. And as long as you... partaking in the activity and being a part of it, whichever way, shape, way, or form, it's just all about experiencing things and training is good. You need training, but it's not we train to do things. We're not just trained to train. We just train to do things. And a kit where we need to put, unfortunately, we haven't got the gills implants yet. but up until then, whatever piece of kit that floats your boat, use it and experience and enjoy it. Just, you know, I think some people take themselves a little bit too seriously and, which is fine, you know, it's not, I don't spend most of my time worrying about that, you know. Yeah,
I hear you.
Absolutely. I agree. So you've obviously you've blazed your own path in the world of diving, but I'm curious, who inspired you along the way?
Oh, man. Remember I talked to you about Lance Jones? Well, he's been my mentor, and he's shaped me into the mentality and the way of thinking that I've been accustomed to. Do you know a guy called Steve Bogarts? Do you know Steve?
Yeah. Don't know him personally, but know who he is. Yep.
Steve is good people, man. He is a good human being. And Steve Bogarts was also Lance's. Steve came in, and Lance took Steve under his wing. We kind of missed each other, and I don't know what the period of time was, so maybe a year or two. So when I left the UK, Lance took Steve under his wing, and so I've got my heart is full of admiration and love for this boy, and I just. You know, he's just a good people, you know, and then coming up, other people who influenced me, we got educators like Jill Hynes, and Jill, again, when I was going to do my wet rock training, I thought there's no other person in a world that I would think that I would like to get trained more than with Jill, and so not only did she she didn't make me say the safe word though, which is great, and she also helped me understand the spiritual side of caves and all the rest of it, which I didn't quite get. She had a massive role, and other people like Becky Kagan Schott, Becky and we're good mates, and photographically, man, I love that girl at bits, man, and we did a talk together at a conference, which I'd been wanting to do for years, and I said, Beck, we would have each other on all the time, and one of Becky's things was she would never go over a 400 ISO, right? That was it for her. And I said, oh, come on, man, like maybe push it to 800. She goes, oh, no ways. So anyway, so we just like have each other on all the time about this, you know. So I ended up asking her. I said, look, do you want to do a talk together, like a photo workshop together? It was the most fun I've had, and Beck and myself. We kind of worked off each other, and we're basically the whole purpose of the photo workshop is that like two people going to the same wreck and doing two completely different photographic styles, and the whole purpose of the thing was to create your own style, to like we want to emulate the people that we respect and we love. We want to emulate their work, but the ultimate is to create your own and to draw from that and so that you walk your own path and then you create your own style. And yeah, that was a lot of fun, you know. That was an immense amount of fun. And, you know, there's other people like Paul Toomer. Do you know Toomer?
Mm-hmm.
He is a madman, I'll tell you. He's an absolute madman. But again, changed the way we the training world thinks, and so there's people like it who are innovative, the likes of Jim Standing and Strikey from Fourth Element. You know, these guys are just incredible visionaries. Bruce and Lynn Partridge of Shearwater. These guys have been on many trips of mine, but Bruce and Lynn, oh my goodness, what visionaries! But the main thing is that they are just fantastic people, all these people shape ourselves into the people that we are, and all the young people coming up to the ranks, you start having a look and see, we need to nurture you guys, we need to make sure that you're still there, and even after all adversities, you still have to buy a couple of pizzas because, that's the only thing you can afford as a diving instructor, Yeah, man, it's all exciting, it's all happy days.
That's awesome. When are you coming to Halifax to go diving? You coming to Nova Scotia, man, anytime soon?
I have got a lot of friends in Canada, and at the first opportunity that I could get, I'm going to be coming out, and I'm going to be coming and staying with you guys.
Good. Yes.
Doors are open.
Doors are open. You can come to the best dive shop on the east coast of Canada, Torpedo Rays Scuba. Nice. We'll show you a great time.
Oh, I can't wait.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, I've actually done a little bit in Canada. I dived at Gunilda out of Rossport. You know the Gunilda?
It rings a bell. I don't know where it is.
That's an awesome wreck. It's a 1911 super yacht that hit a rock. And the owner was too tight to get two barges, and the thing sank. And it's awesome. It just sits there in 80 meters of water. And Gunilda is, mate, it is just an awesome wreck. Anyway, but I will look forward to coming and witnessing some of your amazing diving. And I can't wait.
That would be awesome. And where can people find you online, Pete?
Just give me a ring, I'm always there. I never sleep. No. So just look up, just do a Google search for Lust for Rust. And hopefully, if anyone wants to catch up and messenger me whatever, if you want some advice or you want to just shoot the breeze, just give me a shout anytime, man. I love it. I love talking to fellow divers, and whether it's for photography or just anything, always look forward to meeting new friends.
Before we go, you've had quite the adventure from your initial days of learning to dive in England, and you've been kind enough to share all this, and we've been here for almost 2 hours, so really appreciate it. But last question is...
Anyone getting bored yet?
No, absolutely not. But what keeps you diving, Pete?
People, mate. People keep me diving. I keep my my passion alive through my photography. It's a business. It's a job for me, but I'll never retire. Why would I stop? The older I get, I do less diving. Normally I'd be doing maybe 350 hours a year in the water, and now I've got a new shoulder and aching limbs and everything's falling apart. But we'll keep on going, man. We'll keep on going until taking more pictures. I always love a challenge of photography, that keeps the spark alive. And just teaching people to dive.
Absolutely lovely. Well, it's been a huge pleasure to have you on. I know that Amit is crying over this when he's going to be listening to this. He's a massive fan of yours, as I mentioned earlier, but I just wanted to get it on the record here.
Very kind of him.
Yes, but I think he's going to be chuffed to hear the episode. And we want to thank you again for taking the time, for sharing all those stories, taking us around the world and a little bit back in time as well. It's much, much appreciated, Pete.
Yeah, thanks, guys. You guys are absolute pros. And podcasts are a bit weird because, you know, like you always we're looking at each other at the moment, but when someone's listening to this, they're just going to be sitting, I don't know, like cutting their toenails, I don't know, like doing something else, it's a little bit new for me, I just loving the new experiences. So never do is I never listen to myself. You know, like I'll never play this back, or I'll just be sitting there with my head in my hands, going, "Oh, what the sound like an idiot," you know.
No, Justin's going to make you sound awesome when he's editing this. He's the main guy behind the editing suite.
Yep. Oh well, we'll see about that. You know.
Awesome.
Oh mate, I'm sure he's awesome. Anyway, thanks a lot, guys. That's really, really appreciate the time.
Thanks for tuning into the podcast this week. You can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or at podchaser.com. Reviews are one of the best ways to help others find the podcast.
That does it for today's episode. I want to thank Pete for joining us, and it's been a pleasure. I also want to thank April for joining us tonight.
Yeah, you're welcome, Nick. It was, I think it was our first duo show, just the two of us. So yeah, it was fun.
Are you for real? 99 episodes in, you and I haven't done one together solo?
I don't think we've ever done one just the two of us. I think I've only done one with just Justin. I think this is our first time. Yeah.
Here you go.
You never forget your first, Nick.
That's right. That seems to be a theme on this episode.
It's a theme this episode.
Yeah, I want to thank Justin for doing the editing as he does every week. Even though if he's not present in the episode, he always has a part to play in every single episode of the show. That's sometimes easy to forget. Then I want to thank Amit for setting up the interview. I mean, this was his whole idea. And I hate to say it again. I'm sorry you missed it, Amit, but you're going to love this episode.
We'll send tissues your way for when you listen. Cry because you couldn't make it. Yeah.
But it does sound like Pete's good sport, and he'd be happy to chat with Amit anytime. So, Amit, if you made it this far into the episode, that's your secret.
It's true.
Don't forget, you can support this podcast at patreon.com/diveinpod, and you can get some fun rewards for doing so. Visit our website, diveinpod.com, for all the links you need, episodes, merch, and so much more. You can find me at nicholaswinkler.com.
And on social media, you can find me at April Weichert and Justin at iDiveOK. Next week is our 100th episode, and we have our team movie night.
Yeah, it's going to be a special episode, so tune in for that.
This episode of Dive in the Podcast was brought to you by our sponsor, Torpedo Rays Scuba.
Thank you for listening to Dive in the Podcast.